So we got lots of questions. We'll try to get through a few of these. Some of them are about what the church can do. Let me start with, can you give advice? So lots of advice questions. We good? Can everyone see them okay? Kind of? Most of us? Okay. Can you give advice on how to engage an adherent of critical theory on their own terms or not? Confronting them explicitly sounds a bit oppressive. So can we give advice on how to engage?
That's a very tough question, because I think what I tried to emphasize in the talk was that critical theory today is a worldview. It's like talking to someone in a foreign language. Right? You say, how do you communicate to someone who speaks Chinese? You kind of have to learn their language. It's complicated. It's not just a silver bullet. I think in our book Critical Dilemma, Pat and I lay out several different approaches. I think the most fruitful one is one that recognizes the psychological motivation for critical theorists, which is compassion, or compassion on the vulnerable. That's probably more than anything else what draws people to that worldview. They want to love people. They want to have mercy and protect the vulnerable. And then the issue that I focus on is the issue of transgenderism, which might sound like, oh, it's, boy, you're going right for the jugular. Yes, sort of. Many young people, it's an alarming number of people, are transitioning, say, especially young girls are transitioning to identify as boys. And it's a growing percentage. What's happening, though, simultaneously, is that a number of people are beginning to detransition. They realize, you know what, I'm not a boy, and I was just depressed, and I was fast-tracked very irresponsibly, and I've taken hormones. Maybe I've dressed like a boy for years. Maybe I've had surgery. And they're called detransitioners. And in our book, we include their stories, and some of them they're tragic, and some of them are actually very sad and even angry. And one in particular says, why did no one warn me what I was doing? Why did no one care enough and love me enough to say, this is not you? Let's get you actual help. And it's not going to help you just to cut off your breasts. And when you read these stories, this is in their own first-person voice. They're like, where were my friends? Where were my family? Why are all the doctors just cutting off my body parts? It's tragic. And then you realize, so what's the compassionate response? You say, I'm so compassionate that I affirm their gender. And when they switch back, now they're sterile. Mm-hmm. It makes people think, maybe our compassion has to be tethered to truth. Mm. And love without truth is not love. That's a real, that gets them thinking. Because all of these areas, critical race theory, queer theory, critical pedagogy, they all claim to be all about love and justice, but it's all untethered from what's true. And when that happens, it ends up leading to injustice and hurt and cruelty. So again, that's the one issue where it points to people that are themselves transgender. Actually, a lot of them are out speaking and saying, this happened to me. Don't let it happen to your daughters. And ask them, what's the compassionate choice? And if they say, point out to them, well, then therefore what's actually true matters. That's a really good way to start a conversation about the truth's primacy over compassion and love.
Great. Thank you. Josh, anything to add for that one?
No, it's great.
Good. I'm going to combine a couple on this one. Do you believe the American church, the American Christianity/church, has given a foothold to critical theory in any way? And what can the church do today to better equip our congregations?
You start.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, exactly. So I think, has it given a foothold? Yeah. I think there, I'm just trying to be careful because I'm talking about, I think there are people who have been leaders of well-thought and good movements in the church, and godly people who have bought into some of the framework of critical theory. I think largely, this would be my, I don't know, we haven't talked about this, I don't know whether you agree, I think largely because they were educated in textual things like Greek and Hebrew and stuff like that, which of course is good, but they were pretty uneducated in philosophy, and so they didn't seem to be able to perceive what was going on, and they sort of bought into some of these preconditions. I think the driving motivation for it was often good, because you've got the situation where you're a church leader and you're aware that it's harder to get people to church now than it used to be 15 or so years ago. And so you're trying to build bridges to bring people under the preaching of the word. And you know that you've got this big clash with society on things like LGBTQ stuff. But the being anti-racist, well, Christians are, of course, against racism. So if there's a bridge you can build with people on that issue. So you start thinking, oh, here's a common ground we've got. But I think there have been some leaders who've been insufficiently discerning in this area and have bought into some of their preconditions and used some of the language without knowing what's going on. And it is slippery. I mean, the language, we were chatting about this a little bit, but the language social justice is, I mean, of course, we all want justice in society. That's a good thing. But the language of social justice has so much baggage in it, and then you can buy into all sorts of other things. That are not. So I think there... I don't want you being like the watchman on the gate, wondering what everyone means all the time, but I do think there has been some of that, and it has concerned me in the last 5 years or six, seven years or so. I think what to do about it is to encourage and get people to get their noses in this and preach this, and then let this be the defining agenda and worldview, and let it speak. So we're very big here at College Church, always having the Bible open, having the Bible as part of all we do, and I think that will largely solve the problem.
Good. We good? Yeah. Okay, maybe a little more practical on this one. While helping your child choose a Christian college, what questions should we be asking to understand the role of non-biblical critical theory in the curriculum and the university?
It's going to be there. It doesn't matter where they go, unless they go to, I don't know, some tiny Bible college in Kansas, I guess. It's everywhere. It's in every field. Well, I'm a STEM major. I'm a physicist. Does not matter. You'll be exposed to it. So you should be discerning about if you send your kid to a secular school, it'll be worse. If you send your kid to a super progressive school like, I don't know, Oberlin or Vassar, it'll be even worse. But they're only degrees. Even if all of the students and professors are completely solid biblical Christians, all the professors, the other students might come in and bring in these ideas. So I don't think we're at the stage where you can avoid the problem. I think you need to equip your kids to deal with the problem. I mean, let's say you protect them from critical theory in college, then they enter the workforce, then they have friends. Like it's the virus is out of the lab, right? We had a lab leak. It's not a pandemic. It's a name Nicholas Ritakis gives
endemic.
To it. Endemic, right? It's endemic. It's just everywhere now. So it's like going from a lockdown quarantine situation to like in 2020 to 2024. You're like, well, good luck avoiding COVID. You're going to get it eventually. I think the answer I would give you is yes, absolutely. Talk to the professors. Look at if they're reading D'Angelo and Kendi. That's bad news. You can read it critically if you're reading it as a benchmark. No, it's a bad for instruction. And then old people like Foucault, Freire, yeah. There's some big names you can recognize. But again, I can't tell you, like, if you get a master's in education, you will read Paulo Freire. Paulo Freire is the father of critical pedagogy. His book, Pedagogy of the Oppressed, has sold 1.2 million copies. You're not going to avoid it. So it's much better practice to understand the ideas and inoculate your kids against them than try to avoid them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Next one you both kind of addressed in both the last answers, but maybe think of it a little differently is, again, practically speaking, for many of us perhaps in this room, what advice do you have for Christians who are facing critical theory daily in mandated job DEI training.
Wow.
I can take this one.
You've thought about it a lot.
So I get this question a lot because people do want practical advice. So Helen Pluckrose, who wrote Cynical Theories with James Lindsay, wrote another book just came out called The Counterweight Handbook. Now, she is a progressive atheist. She's not a Christian at all. But she knows her stuff really well. And the Counterweight Handbook is a book that she wrote, the guidebook for navigating DEI-infused woke workplaces. And she literally, at the end of the book, she walks you through what wokeness is. She calls it critical social justice. Like, same, we're on the same page. And then the end has, like, an appendix of form letters you can send to your employer with, like, my name is blank, I work at blank, I'm concerned about blank. And she just has this form letter you can put your information into it that will lay out a case for why you don't approve of this DEI policy. And she is a whole, it's a thin, it's like 200 pages, but of strategies for practically engaging your secular workplace. And the nice thing is that because she's an atheist, she's approaching the how to deal with this not from a biblical perspective that they will reject. They won't care. But from the perspective of a classical liberal. For example, like she'd say, don't you value freedom or free speech, freedom of conscience? Don't you care about respecting people's values? They say, oh, yeah, sure. Well, here are my values. I don't want to judge people by their skin color. Do you agree with that? They're like, well, of course we do. Well, this is why your training, based on Robin DiAngelo and Edward Kendi, does not allow for me to respect my values. So it's really carefully designed. And the reason she wrote it was because she runs an organization called Counterweight, which was fielding like hundreds of questions from people saying, like, I'm getting DEI training in my workplace. What do I do? So she put this book together. So it is the only book I know literally out there right now that is very practical from a secular perspective on how to address your supervisors, your company. Don't ever be ashamed to say, I'm a Christian. These are my views biblically. But also don't expect them to share those views. So then use the views that they do hold, like freedom, respect, diversity. She's like, do you believe in diversity? They're like, absolutely. How about diversity of thought? They're like, But she points out, if you care about diversity, you respect the diversity of thought that I bring to your team. I'm a Christian. You want to exclude me? Oh, no, we're all about inclusion. Excellent. So, again, there are ways to frame your concerns that will push the right buttons, in a sense. And she's very good about it. And book page, I am writing a sequel to Critical Dilemma that will be a totally practical guide. It'll be out in 2026, so you'll have to wait for that.
Good. Thanks, Neil. Anything? You got anything on that one?
I was just thinking, I'm not sure it's I remember when we were, I don't know whether you were there then, when we were at Yale, when the, I was trying to get us to have a Baptist representation at Yale, which was not exactly a particularly easy thing to do. And I remember the chaplain, the guy who was in control of that process, and was interviewing me. And I sort of said to him, look, you're going to have a Baptist representation here, and I'm going to be the best you're ever going to get in your life. It could be a lot worse. And then he let us in. And I think there's you're pointing to like the wisdom of finding a within their own thought framework, because they wanted diversity.
Yeah.
They wanted, you know, they had Buddhists and Muslims and, you know, people all sorts of different lifestyles. And like, there was I with a conservative evangelical. And I was like, you know, I'm here. I'm going to be a part of it. And it seemed to work just fine if you... if you appeal to things they hold as values, yeah. So what's the name of that book? Say it again.
It's Counterweight Handbook. The Counterweight Handbook is the Helen Pluckrose is the author.
Good, thanks. Isn't critical theory self-defeating? If the power structures are overturned, are they now not the ones in power and thus oppressors?
Yeah, so here's the thing. Critical theorists don't really care much about consistency, right? Because that's a hegemonic white narrative, right? So they're suffusing critical theorist work. There are these contradictions. So that one is like, well, if you're going to get rid of the power structure, what does that mean? Aren't you, to me, you're going to have the power now, and you're going to impose your values, critical theory's values, on culture. Another way to say that is that you're against hegemonic narratives, the ruling class imposing their values on culture, but you love DEI programs being mandated for every person in the nation. What's our current cultural zeitgeist hegemonic narrative? Diversity, equity, inclusion. It's everywhere. Look at Pride Month. It's a secular holiday. It lasts a month. And Target's not changing their merchandise for like Arbor Day anymore. It's, you know. But they don't care. Their formal answer would be, our hegemonic narrative is non-oppressive. That's why we get a pass. See, our hegemonic narrative, the Christian narrative is oppressive, the white narrative is oppressive. But see, under our hegemonic narrative, we're including everybody. But they're not. They're excluding all of us. They're excluding all of the Christians and the Jews and the Muslims who have their own narratives that they say, no, our narrative is exclusive. This is a classic inclusivity-exclusivity problem. The inclusivists want everybody included except for the exclusivists. But the bottom line is that when you talk to theorists, they're not... The Frankfurt School was very critical of what they called instrumental rationality, the idea that like all problems are just math problems. Like, you just use logic and apply logic to solve problems. They're like, you have to have values that are not reducible to logic. And what's their value then? Their value is social transformation. They don't so much care about the truth as they care about transferring society to get to a certain destination. And this gets far afield, but for example, the 1619 Project New York Times did to revise American history and say we were actually founded in 1619, a lot of historians came out and said, hey, I'm a progressive, this is just bad history. But the answer is it doesn't matter what the actual truth is because the goal is what matters. We're going to transform society, and so the facts can kind of take a back seat. In the same way, when you catch a critical theorist in these contradictions, the answer might be they'll have some, you know, they'll make some spin move and they'll juke you, but really it's because they've displaced truth as the primary virtue and promoted activism as the ultimate, that's the end goal that they want. They don't really care about truth, it kind of takes the latter part. So that's the behind their reasoning why they think that way. If you want more on that, Carl Truman has a new book called To Change All Worlds, where he examines the history of the Frankfurt School, focusing just on neo-Marxism. And he says the same thing.
Say the book again, Neil?
Carl Truman has a new book. It might be out now. It's called To Change All Worlds, I think. And it's on the Frankfurt School. But this goes back to the 20s, to Marx himself. This is not a new philosophy. It's old.
Okay, good. Neil, in particular, on this one, you referenced a couple of authors and individuals in the critical theory camp. However, they may not consider themselves as such. How does one respond to someone who doesn't think they're in that worldview?
Okay, so the people like D'Angelo and Kendi, this is, you have to get my book. they're incredibly disingenuous. So D'Angelo will be interviewed by CNN. We have a quote in the book. They'll say, are you a critical race theorist? And she's like, well, critical race theory is just a legal theory, and it's a very esoteric discipline. And so by that standard, I'm not a critical race theorist. And I'm just like, and people will on Twitter will quote her and say, see, she's not a critical race theorist. I'm like, go to her website. The banner is Robin D'Angelo, PhD, critical race educator in big letters, right? And then they're like, but she's a critical race educator, not a theorist. I'm like, oh my gosh. Like, it's, and Kendi does the same thing. Kendi has this juke where he says, I'm not a critical race theorist. I just really appreciate Kimberly Crenshaw, who coined the term critical race theory and the term intersectionality and is the most well-cited critical race theorist in history. The point is, well, I put it this way. They may not identify as a critical race theorist, say, but they are doing critical race theory. Like, in other words, you know, if Christianity is outlawed one day in the U.S. and the police kick down the door on Sunday morning and Josh is up here holding the Bible and preaching, and they say, are you preaching the gospel? He's like, no. We call it the good news around here, right? he might not identify as a gospel preacher, but he is doing the work of gospel preaching. So it's the same sort of thing. So when it comes to Christians, what I often say is there might be a Christian or a leader who says, well, I reject critical race theory. I just think X, Y, Z. The question, you could say to them, well, okay, I know you don't identify as a critical race theorist, but what you're saying is what critical race theorists say. But even better, just say this, what you're saying isn't true. I don't care where it comes from. Let's compare it to the Bible. So actually, I actually have an article I wrote on like how to preach against CRT without mentioning CRT. Say, well, this idea, which does come from critical race theory, this idea is not biblical. And this one, which comes from CRT, is not biblical. And you never mention CRT. You just say this idea, wherever it comes from. That's just a better way to approach the problem.
Excellent. Some Christians emphasize equity, examine racial quotas, and lament structural racism. How might this reinforce critical theory rather than biblical truth?
Yeah, all right. So, structural, systemic, institutional racism, they're actually different concepts. It certainly can exist. Jim Crow, chattel slavery, apartheid, these are structural, systemic things. This is not a, John Piper points out, this is not a category error. Yes, sins can be systemic. Abortion, it's not just, you know, a few bad people. It's a whole system functioning to kill the unborn. There are laws, there are social mores, there are all kinds, there are movies, there are lobbyists. So systemic sin is a category, it's real. The real problem with things like equity and systemic racism is not that it can be a real category, even a biblical category, but that they define it in a way that's not compatible with the Bible. So for example, equity, no matter what anyone tells you, if you read the literature carefully, it really is a quality of outcome. It boils down to that. There's lots of reading to do, but quality of outcome is not biblical, and everyone should realize that, because people that don't work hard should not receive the same benefits as people that do work hard, right? I mean, people you're not going to have equality of outcome across lazy people versus hardworking people. You shouldn't. It would be unjust. For example, systemic racism is similar in that the way that most scholars define it actually boils down to: a system is systemically racist if it produces racial disparities, right? But not all systems that produce disparities are unjust. For example, the one I always use, which people have used on Kendi a bazillion times, the NBA is 70% black. Is that because they hate white people? Is that because they're unfairly being anti-white, discriminating against white players? No, it's because black players are better than white players. There's nothing unjust about that at all. It's actually a just outcome. So that's, and Kendi's been given that example so many times, and he won't admit he's wrong. But the point is not that it can't exist. So in our book, we point out there are studies showing that, for example, that black applicants receive callbacks at 35% lower rates than white applicants with all things being controlled. They actually have pairs. They send out people matched pairs, or carefully controlled studies where they have a white applicant, black applicant, same resume, same GPAs, same height, same physical attractiveness. I don't know how they measure it. They actually pair them up, send them out, and the black guy gets fewer callbacks just because he's black. This is a well-known phenomenon. There's like 24 studies of this over the course of 44 decades. The callback rate has not changed in 4 decades. Right? Since 1970 or something like that. So it's a real phenomenon, but it's exaggerated, and critical race theorists don't peer at the data. They have this vibe, but they just know it's out there. So there's a lot more to say. The bottom line is that be careful with those phrases. Don't dismiss them totally, because they are real things that actually do happen. But also, I would stay away from those phrases, because they often carry baggage that you don't want to import into your discussion. But I'll just caution you, it's complicated. Don't call everything Marxist. That's a big no-no, because sometimes it's not. It's more nuanced than you think.
We have a lot of people wondering where Josh got those socks.
It wasn't from a critical theorist.
All right, maybe time for one more.
Yeah.
How does critical theory handle someone in dual categories of oppressor and oppressed, say like a wealthy black man or a poor homeless Christian?
Critical theorists.
Come on. All right. Well, this is a great question, because this is the theory of intersectionality. This is what it was designed to handle. So Kimberly Crenshaw was one of the first critical race theorists. She coined the term intersectionality She coined the phrase critical race theory, so she's like a go-to person to understand these theories. And the way that she explained intersectionality in 1989, 1991 in papers was that you can't reduce a black woman's identity to just black plus just female. Then you add them together, you get a black woman. Experience of a black woman is not just the experience of a black man plus experience of a white woman combined. They're unique, that her identities combine in complicated ways to produce new experiences and new forms of discrimination. And you're like, well, that sounds like a lot of woo. Well, no, actually, she points out there's a lawsuit against General Motors. She's a legal scholar. The lawsuit against GM, where GM was claimed to be discriminating against black women. Okay, so black women brought the lawsuit. And GM says, now, they pointed out, like, we have plenty of black people and we have plenty of women. So what's the deal? And Crenshaw says, wait a minute, but you have plenty of black men and plenty of white women and no black women. See, you avoided a discrimination law by avoiding this one subcategory, but they have no recourse because you have points for the black men, points for the white women, and see, they're free now. She says, hey, that's not fair because uniquely black women are being discriminated against. I'm like, that's actually a reasonable point. I mean, if I were really sneaky, I could do that. So, but from that seed of an idea grew this theory that says, actually, our identities are complicated. We're not just have a race and a gender and a class and education. We have all these things at once, and that can lead to unique experiences, unique forms of oppression. So far, so good. But then that deals with things like, what if you're a white woman? So she would then say, ah, if you're a white woman, you're not merely oppressed because you're a woman. You're not merely an oppressor because you're white. You contain both identities. And it's sort of a unique category now. But how that cashes out is that this is very serious. Actually, you can see it in culture. They would say that Oprah is doubly oppressed because she's a black woman. And they would say that a homeless, drug addicted Vietnam vet in Alaska, disabled in a wheelchair, is a white male, has white privilege and male privilege. It's real. They would truly say Oprah is oppressed in a way that white privileged male is not, even though she's literally a billionaire and he is totally broken, bankrupt, and sick. And I understand how they're thinking about that, but their thinking is just wrong. Because the absolute scale of someone's oppression matters. It's not just the relative. They would say, well, see, if only Oprah were a white man, she'd be even better off. And if this poor white guy were a black woman, he'd be even worse off. But yes, but their actual objective status matters. Oprah is in no sense oppressed. Oprah could buy everything that I own 1,000 times and still, you know, do it 100 more times. That's what they do. But they truly believe that if you have black skin, no matter all your other benefits, you are still oppressed on that axis. And if you have white skin and are totally miserable, you still have privilege. Which, again, to normal people doesn't sound right, but that's how they think about it.
Okay, good. Last one. Josh, from a pastoral perspective, a lot of questions about protecting our children, preparing our children. This one, there's widespread youth depression and anxiety today that was not present decades ago. Is that a role of critical theory, and what can we do as a family to better address that?
Yeah, I think that I think that's real. I mean, we talk to parents and youth ministry workers, and I think that's a real phenomenon. So just to affirm it. And I do, each case of anxiety and depression is different. So you can't just come out with a blanket solution to every possible person who may be facing anxiety. So if you have a child in your life that way, then, you know, come up and talk to me afterwards. There may be some particular things to say. It could be a good idea to get professional counseling help, but that isn't always the right next step. And so again, it'd be good for you to talk to a pastor, try and discern what the right next step would be. From a sociological, so that's like particular, like take it, each case is different, happy to help afterwards. From a sort of general social perspective, we've seen that dynamic grow in society and in the church. And I think there are a number of different reasons for that. You can point to technology. I do think technology has some, I mean, the doom scrolling, and it is addictive, and you're constantly being exposed to idealistic lifestyles that don't match your own. I think that's a factor. I think that COVID was tough for many kids and many adults too, and that's sort of, there's a long tail of that that continues in people's lives in some respects. I think that's another factor as well. So we're not talking about something clinical. We're talking about a response to current environment issues. The key is to get someone into relationships in the local church with the Bible at the heart of it, so that they begin to see themselves as God sees them rather than as they might self-perceive. There's a wonderful Spurgeon quotation where he talks about feelings. And he goes on about, like, I might feel great tonight and feel terrible tomorrow morning, but God is still God. But if we're living in a world whereby we self-identify by what we feel, then of course we're going to feel terrible. Because one moment we might feel great, next moment we're going to feel disastrous. And there will be, and that's... I think we're not talking about something like majorly clinical. We're talking about a response to the sort of current zeitgeist of our time. It's getting, here we are, plug for a God-centered life. It's getting God back into the center and the self out of the center, which paradoxically then gives us a secure self. And that, of course, is the task of the local church and the task of God-centered life ministry.
Sounds like a plug for the Bible.
It does,
and church.
Yeah.
That's right. All right, Josh and Neil, thank you so much for bringing this.